You know, Stone said, allowing himself to be led toward where the bourbon was, I own a Hinckley 43 already, which is at my house in England. I know that, Jack replied. I guess that means Betty won't have to sell you on it. I am not buying a boat, Stone said. 8. Stone finished his Knob Creek just as the bartender set down another. He took the papers out of the envelope and scanned them quickly. The boat was equipped almost identically to his own in England, but with a few extra options.
"How much is Betty asking?" Stone said to Jack Spotswood.
"I believe a new one is going for around 2 million," Jack replied.
"They've gone up the past couple of years?"
"Hasn't everything?"
"You didn't answer my question. How much is she asking?"
I'll tell you the truth, Stone. She's all alone now, and she's cash poor. I think she'll accept any reasonable offer.
I don't want to take advantage of a widow's situation, Stone said.
Just offer her whatever you think is fair.
Stone took another gulp of the bourbon, then a deep breath.
Offer her 1.8 million, he said.
I'll be right back, Jack replied.
He walked to the other end of the bar and exchanged a few words with Betty Kohler, then returned.
"Betty gratefully accepts your offer," Jack said. He took the sheaf of papers and removed the last page. "Here's the contract I drew up for her."
He wrote in Stone's name and the price.
"Initial in the two places and sign right here."
Stone took another swig of the bourbon, then quickly read the contract, signed, and handed it to Jack. He got out his iPhone and tapped out an email to Joan, then sent it.
"Joan will transfer the funds to your firm's account tomorrow," he said to Jack.
Jack walked back down the bar, delivered the contract to Betty, who smiled broadly and waved. Jack returned.
"Congratulations, Stone, and thank you for making that gentlemanly offer. And by the way, everything on the yacht is in perfect working order. The bottom is clean, and the boat is still under warranty for another 4.5 years.
Dino waved at him from a table.
"Join us for dinner?" Stone asked Jack. "Thanks, but I'm meeting some people. Your copy of the contract is in the envelope."
Stone walked over to the table and sat down.
"Don't tell us," Dino said. "You just bought a boat."
Stone finished his drink and waved for another.
"God help me, I did."
"Let's go look at it," Viv said.
"Tomorrow. Right now I'm starving."
"I've never seen anything like it," Meg said. "You started the day homeless, clubless, and yachtless, in Key West, and you've put all that together in a single day."
Stone managed a weak smile. "I guess I have," he said.
Gino and Veronica Bellini checked into the Royal Suite at the Dorchester Hotel in London. He plugged in his laptop and checked his email.
"My goodness," Gino said. "Miss Meg's driverless cars, 6 in New York and 1 in Key West, seem to have gone awry. Harmony Software has already reached out for my help."
"Isn't that a pity?" Veronica said, lifting the back of his toupee and kissing his bald head. "Now, tell me what you're getting out of this."
"Satisfaction, pure satisfaction," Gino replied. "And a big settlement when I tell them how to fix it."
His cell phone rang, and he answered it.
"Mr. Bellini, this is Frank Simmons at Harmony Software."
"Hi there, Frank. What can I do for you?"
"Did you get my email? We've got a major glitch in the driverless car software, and we need your help."
"My help? Why, I thought you folks were getting along just fine without my help."
Be that as it may, we'd like to retain you as a consultant on the project.
On what terms?
1 year, $2 million.
Sorry, Frank, I'm a busy man.
What will it take, Gino? Tell me.
3 years at $5 million a year, and I don't work on site, just wherever I happen to be when you need me.
Please hold for a moment.
He's checking with Meg, Gino said to Veronica.
Simmons came back.
Done. I'll email you a contract. You can sign it, scan it, and return it.
Meg will do the same.
Now we need you to go into the beta version and fix whatever is causing the cars to stop running.
Just as soon as I receive the contract, signed by Meg.
Tomorrow morning.
All right, Frank. I'll fix Meg's toy. It will be done by noon, Florida time, tomorrow.
Oh, and I'll need the latest sign-ins and passwords.
Thank you. Your contract is on the way to Meg.
Nice doing business with you, Frank, Gino said, then hung up.
It worked? Veronica asked.
To the tune of $15 million over 3 years, Gino replied, grinning.
Meg hung up her cell phone.
You look glum, Stone said. Anything I can do to help?
They were in the middle of dinner.
No, I've just fixed the problem, but it cost me $15 million out of my own pocket.
What does that fix?
The cars. We should be able to go on with the demonstration to the board. I'll need to borrow your computer and printer when we get back to the house.
Stone poured them all more wine.
Meg, he said, I get the feeling that extortion may be involved here.
And very likely more to come, she replied.
The Bellinis dined at Le Gavroche, possibly London's finest restaurant, and holder of 3 stars from the Guide Michelin.
I think you should do some shopping tomorrow, he said to Veronica.
You've read my mind, she replied.
How much can I spend?
I never thought I'd hear myself say these words, but whatever you like.
I never thought I'd hear you say those words, she replied, but they sound very sweet.
I'm a very sweet guy, Gino said, as the sommelier tipped more Chateau Lafitte 1978 into their glasses.
9. Stone navigated his new boat out of its berth, across Garrison Bight, through Key West Harbor, then turned west into open water and pushed the throttles of the Hinckley 43 to 3,200 RPMs. Soon they were cruising at a little better than 30 knots.
"How long to our destination?" Meg asked from the big, comfortable seat beside him.
It's about 70 miles, so a bit more than 2 hours. The calm seas will keep us fast and comfortable.
What's it like out there?
It's better if you see it for yourself.
Stone tapped in half a dozen waypoints on the moving map before him and engaged the autopilot, which took charge and pointed them at the first waypoint. Dino and Viv came in from the cockpit.
It's getting pretty windy back there, Dino said.
Grab a beer and make yourself comfortable in the cabin.
Stone arranged himself in the helmsman's chair so that he could see both the moving map and Meg by shifting his gaze.
I'm concerned about you, he said.
Oh, why?
Well, I've known you for only a few days, but who I'm seeing now is not the happy person I saw earlier this week, she sighed.
I'm just afraid that by paying this extortion, as you put it, I'm buying into more problems than I'm solving.
That's often the way it is with extortion or blackmail. It's very likely that he'll ask you for considerably more.
What hold does he have over you? The keys to the kingdom, you might say. Gino Bellini has what you might call a checkered background, she said. He was a troubled youth, spent some time in reform school for hacking and computer theft, and narrowly avoided prison. He was rescued from that life by a mentor, a professor of computer science at Stanford, who got him a scholarship there. He didn't graduate. He was sucked out of there by a Silicon Valley startup, not mine, not yet, and he began making more money than he would ever have imagined possible, $500,000 a year and more. Still, as I was to learn, he retained that part of his psyche that controlled criminality.
He's a born criminal, you mean?
Not exactly. That was learned behavior, I think. But it still seems to remain an important part of the way he thinks. When I let him go and paid him off for his share of the company, I thought that would be the end to it. I mean, even after taxes, he was sitting on more than $100 million. You'd think that would be enough to satisfy him, but no. It chafed on him that I was making more than $1 billion on the deal, never mind that the concept was mine, and that I had secured the financing, supervised his coding, and ran the business, while his job was to sit at his computer and make my ideas work. He still managed to believe that somehow I had wronged him, cheated him out of his fair share.
I hope you had a good attorney when you were setting up the business and writing employment contracts.
Oh, yes, the best legal minds in Silicon Valley were paid exorbitant sums to make sure that a situation like this could never arise.
Sometimes good lawyers are worth whatever you pay them, Stone said, with a little reproval in his voice.
Oh, I know that, and I don't question either the quality of their work or what I paid them. I just don't think they ever realized who they were dealing with in Gino's case, nor did I, for that matter.
A good contract covers legalities, Stone said.
It's difficult to predict illegalities, though every attorney tries to. Has Bellini committed any criminal act that you know of?
I suspect so, Meg replied. I suspect that he's planted little bombs in our software that can be triggered whenever he likes.
Have you caught him at it?
My people can't even find the bombs, let alone prove that he put them there. I think what he's doing is using a password that he set up some time ago to get into the programs and set off the bombs. And now, because of the deal I've made with him, he has the current passwords necessary to do that, the aforementioned keys to the kingdom. He knew the demonstration to the steel board was coming up, and how important that would be to the company's success, and he's managed to turn that into $15 million in his pocket.
Will there be other opportunities for him to do that?
Oh, yes. We'll be turning over our prototypes and our software to the state of California and the U.S. government soon, and it's critical that we get certification from both. Otherwise, we won't be able to go into production and do large-scale fleet testing of the vehicles. I'll tell you this, Stone, in the strictest confidence, last night I was thinking of trying to find someone to kill the man.
Whoa, Stone said. Even if that were successful, like the bribe you paid, it would create more problems for you than it would solve.
My brain tells me that, but my gut wants him dead, she said.
Let me explain how this would go, Stone said. First of all, you'd have to find a contract killer, a hitman. Do you know someone who might know someone who does that? She laughed.
The only person I know who might know someone like that is Gino Bellini.
Stone laughed. What happens when someone like you tries to find someone like that is that you have to deal with criminals, people who can't be trusted, no matter how much money they are being offered. Often these people are already snitches for one or more police officers or FBI agents. They're out on parole, maybe, and they want to endear themselves to the people who have the power to send them back to prison. You'd find yourself handing over money in an alley or a bar somewhere to an officer of the law who will then arrest you and charge you with conspiracy to murder. It's a losing game. She shrugged. Maybe I should just lure Gino into a back alley and shoot him myself, she said. Then I wouldn't have to trust anybody, and I'd save a lot of money.
And you would almost certainly spend the rest of your life in prison.
Why? I'm smart. Why couldn't I get away with it?
You're talking to a former homicide detective, and I can tell you from experience that there are so many ways to make mistakes, and so many techniques available to the police for finding those mistakes, that you'd have very little chance of success. All it takes is one little mistake, and you're done. The best you could hope for is to hire the world's most expensive defense lawyer who might somehow win a trial and get you off. You'd spend more than you've already given Bellini on your defense. Then his wife would bring a civil suit against you for wrongful death, which you could easily lose, and for the rest of your life, at least half the people who know and love you would believe that you're a murderer, and that would be hard to live with.
I suppose you're right, Meg said disconsolately.
Ask O.J. Simpson, Stone said.
The autopilot turned the yacht toward the last waypoint, and ahead, low islands came into sight.
10.
Gino Bellini switched off his laptop.
There, he said, Miss Meg is up and running again, for the moment at least.
Have you given up on just killing her outright? Veronica asked.
No, I haven't, Gino replied. Dirty Joe is still on the hunt in Key West.
That didn't go so well last time. We had to run for it.
I've instructed him to wait until he has a shot in some out-of-the-way spot, where the police can't be all over him in a minute.
You're going to let her do her demonstration to the steel board?
Of course. I want her to have the illusion of progress until I can hit her again, or until Dirty Joe can.
Who is Dirty Joe? You haven't told me anything about him.
Joe Cross. We did some time together in a California reform school when we were just kids, and we kept in touch. We called him Dirty Joe even then, because there was nothing he wouldn't do for money. When I was at Stanford, he dealt marijuana on campus. When I was in Silicon Valley, he upped his game to cocaine, which was the propellant of choice there in those days. On the side, he'd do hits, and he always got away with it. He sort of retired to the Keys, living up in Islamorada, but he's always receptive to the opportunity for fast cash.
And you think he can handle this?
He hasn't done a day of time since reform school, and that record was expunged when he was 21, so he's on nobody's list of suspects, which is usually the problem when you want somebody hit. The police look at the record first.
But he hit the wrong person in Key West. Doesn't that bother you?
It was a windy day, and that was as close as he could get. If we're patient, Dirty Joe will come through, and Meg's inferiors will be a lot easier to deal with.
Dirty Joe Cross and his girlfriend, Jane Gillian, known to her friends as Jungle Jane, sat back a mile or so in their offshore boat, a 36-footer with three large outboards clamped to the stern, and Joe watched through his binoculars as the blue Hinckley rounded Fort Jefferson and picked up a mooring in the little harbor.
"They're down for the night," Joe said, "and the light's going. We're not going to get a shot at them before tomorrow morning. We got anything to eat aboard?"
"No problem," Jane replied.
If you want fresh fish, I'll catch you something for supper.
Good idea, he said. Snapper, maybe.
Whatever the sea yields, she replied. If you want to get picky, find yourself a fish restaurant. The nearest one is about 70 miles away.
I'll eat whatever you put in front of me, Joe said.
The harbor was empty of other boats, and Stone was glad of it.
Dino, Viv, and I were out here last Christmas, he said to Meg.
Tell me about the fort, Meg asked.
It was built sometime before the Civil War, and during the war it was used as a prison for Union deserters. The only reason a lot of people ever heard of it was when there was a yellow fever epidemic on the island, and Dr. Samuel Mudd was imprisoned here for the crime of aiding and abetting John Wilkes Booth after he assassinated Abraham Lincoln. Booth had broken his leg when he jumped from Lincoln's box to the stage at Ford's Theater, and he fled into Maryland, where he stopped at Dr. Mudd's house for help along the road south. Mudd knew Booth, but treated him anyway, and didn't report him until the following day. As a result, he was convicted along with the other conspirators and sentenced to life in prison. He was sent to Fort Jefferson, and while he was here, yellow fever broke out, and Mudd heroically saved many lives, for which he was eventually pardoned by the president.
"I hope there's no yellow fever now," Meg said.
"Nope, it's now a national park." They had a drink, and Dino and Viv grilled steaks for dinner.
The following morning, after a good breakfast and a Bloody Mary, Stone broke out the rubber dinghy from its locker and inflated it, then launched it over the stern and fastened the outboard to it. Viv pleaded Freckles, and Dino stayed with her, while Stone and Meg took the dinghy to Loggerhead Key, a mile or so away.
"It looks deserted," Meg said. "Can I go without a suit here?"
"I'm counting on it," Stone said. "Tan lines aren't allowed on Loggerhead."
He pulled the dinghy up onto the beach. They left their swimsuits aboard and swam for a while, then got out and let the wind dry them as they walked up the beach. Dirty Joe Cross and Jungle Jane Jillian approached Fort Jefferson slowly, then saw a couple leave the moored yacht in a rubber dinghy. He took a look through his glasses.
"Bingo," he said. "And they seem to be heading for Loggerhead."
With Jane at the helm, they motored slowly along on a route parallel to the beach, and Joe went below and came back with an AR-15-style assault rifle and shoved a banana clip into it, watching as the couple swam, then walked up the beach.
"Man, she looks good naked," Joe said.
"Watch out, or I'll kick your ass," Jane replied. He knew she would, too.
"Okay, okay, just drift for a while. I can't hit anything if we're underway."
Jane did as instructed.
"How close in do you want to be?"
100 yards or so, and go at idle speed."
She slowly closed the gap between them and the beach.
"They haven't even seen us," Joe said. "This is going to be a piece of cake."
"Who's the guy?" Jane asked.
"Who gives a shit?" Joe came back. "If he gets in the way, he's dead meat. This is a good distance. Take the engines out of gear, but be ready to leave fast toward Key West."
Jane put the engines into neutral, and they idled adrift. Joe tried standing, but couldn't get steady enough. He knelt and braced the rifle against the gunwale of the boat. He checked the wind and distance, adjusted the scope, and checked the view. Looking good. Stone and Meg walked along on the wet sand at the water's edge. Then she stopped and pulled him around toward her. He took her in his arms and pressed her against his body, then kissed her.
Joe sighted through the scope and took a good look. A headshot wasn't going to do it. Even a little movement of the boat made that an unlikely hit. The woman's back was to him, and he placed the crosshairs between her shoulder blades, took a deep breath, let it out, then began to squeeze the trigger. As he fired, he felt a breeze on the back of his neck and swore. Stone felt a breeze, too, at the moment he heard the crack of the rifle. He swept Meg's legs from under her, and they both hit the sand. 11. Stone looked around for shelter. No trees, not even shrubs for 50 yards, and he didn't want to get any farther from the dinghy. He looked out at the boat off the beach. It had begun to turn slowly away from them. A man stood up, holding a rifle, and Stone could hear him swearing.
"Turn the goddamn thing back on course," the man yelled at a woman who was at the helm.
She put the engines into gear and started to turn back toward them.
"Quick," Stone said to Meg. He helped her to her feet, grabbed her hand, and they ran away from the beach toward some dunes, diving behind the nearest one as the rifle could be heard again and flying sand scattered around them.
"Keep your belly on the ground," Stone said to Meg, "and crawl back toward the dinghy. The dune gets higher as we go."
Then he heard automatic fire and hugged the sand beneath him. The guy with the rifle was swearing again, yelling instructions at the woman. Stone looked up, and the boat was again stern to their position.
"Okay, let's go," he said to Meg, and they began crawling as fast as they could.
Shots rang out again, but hit the top of the dune behind them. The shooter had lost their position.
"Lie very still now," he said.
"Where are they?" Jane asked. "How the fuck do I know?" Dirty Joe yelled back. "They're behind that fucking dune. And I need another magazine."
He went below to get one. Then Stone heard a clattering sound from some distance away. He risked sticking his head up long enough to find its source. Dino was weighing the anchor they had put out to reinforce their mooring. Stone thanked Hinckley that raising the anchor involved only the pressing of a switch, not physical labor. He ducked back down.
"Dino's on the way," he said to Meg.
"Does he know how to operate that jet stick thing you've been using?" she asked.
"Sort of," Stone replied. "He'll get the hang of it."
The automatic fire started again, and the shooter was panning toward them, rounds ripping off the peak of the dune as they hit.
"Stay down," Stone said, as if that were necessary.
He heard the engines on the Hinckley start up, but he was afraid to check on Dino's progress.
"Their boat is moving," Jane shouted, and Dirty Joe stopped firing and looked at it as it accelerated.
He turned his rifle back toward the beach and got off another burst, then dropped the magazine and shoved in another.
"This is my last one," he said to Jane.
Then there was a single shot from the direction of the blue yacht and an almost simultaneous whack as the bullet struck the radome on top of his cabin.
"Oh, shit. Those people are armed. Let's get the hell out of here. Head for Key West."
Jane did as ordered and shoved the throttles forward. The boat leaped ahead.
"Why Key West? We don't want to go there."
"When we're out of their sight, we'll turn for Isla Morada," Joe replied.
Stone raised his head now and saw the boat roar away, its three outboards howling. He looked back at the Hinckley and saw Dino's head protruding from an open hatch in the cabin roof. He was standing on the skipper's seat firing a handgun at the retreating speedboat. Stone stood up now.
"The shooter is out of here," he said to Meg. "Let's get to our dinghy."
They ran down the dune and back up the beach to where they had dragged the dinghy ashore. They launched it, climbed in, and Stone started the outboard. A moment later, Dino had stopped the Hinckley, and they were pulling up to the stern boarding platform of the yacht, where Viv stood waiting to take their painter.
"Are you too hurt?" Viv asked.
"No, we're fine," Stone said. "Just a little sandy."
He tied up the dinghy, then got out the stern shower and adjusted the water temperature. He hosed Meg down as she stood on the boarding platform, then did the same for himself.
"How nice to have hot water," Meg said.
"I'll get us robes."
She went forward toward their cabin. Stone went to the pilot's seat and turned the yacht back toward their anchorage.
"I'm sorry we didn't get here sooner,"
Dino said, clearing his weapon and laying it on the dashboard.
"If we hadn't had that anchor out, we might have had a real chance of arriving in time to hit them. As it was, I think I got their radome. I didn't see the boat's name, did you?"
"No, there were three outboard engines blocking the view of the stern," Stone said.
"We had no chance of catching up to them," Dino said. "That thing probably does 50 knots with all that power. They're headed toward Key West, though. You want to go back?"
"What's the point?" Stone asked. "By the time we get there, they'll be tucked into a berth somewhere, and there are thousands of them. Did you recognize what kind of boat it was?"
Dino shook his head.
"Nothing I've seen before."
"I never even got to my weapon," Viv said. "It was all too fast."
Viv, like Dino, went everywhere armed. It was the ex-cop in her. Meg brought Stone a robe, and he got into it. Then they motored slowly back and picked up their mooring again. This time, he didn't lower the anchor. Dino got out his phone.
"I'll call this in, and maybe we can have them met in Key West."
He stared at his phone.
"Zero reception out here."
He grabbed the VHF microphone, pressed the on button, and dialed in Channel 15.
"Coast Guard, Coast Guard," he said. "Stone, what's the name of our yacht?"
"It doesn't seem to have one," Stone replied. "I guess the previous owner didn't get around to it."
"Coast Guard, this is Hinckley Yacht. Calling from Fort Jefferson. Do you read?"
"This is the Coast Guard," a voice came back weakly. "What is your condition and your request?"
"We're safely afloat," Dino replied, "but two people on another boat fired an assault rifle at two of our party on Loggerhead Beach."
"Anyone injured?"
"No. And the shooters departed in the direction of Key West, going very fast."
"Describe their craft."
"Maybe 35 feet, powered by 3 large outboards. Very fast. We returned fire with a handgun, and I think we hit their radome."
"I'll alert our Key West station and the police," the man said. "Give me your name, address, and phone number."
Dino gave him his office information and his cell number.
"Do you require any assistance?"
"Negative,"
Dino replied.
"Leave your radio on Channel 15 in case we need to contact you," the man said.
"Will do. Oh, and you might contact Detective Harry Corfelt at the Key West PD. He would be interested to hear about this."
"Roger, and out."
Dino turned to Viv.
"Who do I have to fuck around here to get a drink?"
"I am that person," Viv replied, handing him a scotch.
"How long do I have to wait to get paid?"
"Not long," Dino said, kissing her.
They were given a couple of snappers from a passing sports fisherman, and Stone got the grill fired up again. 12. When they were back in their berth at the Key West Yacht Club,
Stone phoned his friend and Viv's boss, Michael Freeman at Strategic Services, the world's second-largest security company.
"How are things in Key West?" Mike asked.
"Not the most fun I ever had," Stone replied, then told him what had happened.
"How can I help?"
"Meg Harmon, you know about her?"
"I do."
"She has a demonstration of her new self-driving car at the Casa Marina Hotel here, for the benefit of the Steel Group board. She's going to need some personal protection, given what happened."
"Is Viv there?"
"Right here."
"Put her on, and we'll work it out."
Viv sat down with the phone and had a brief conversation with Mike, then ended the call and handed the phone back to Stone. "We'll have a team of six at the Casa Marina by 9 tomorrow morning," she said, "loaded for bear."
"That's a relief to know."
"I didn't think we would need security at your house."
"Quite right. I don't think this Bellini guy knows about the house."
Jack Spotswood ambled over from his boat and was given a drink. Stone didn't tell him about the shooter.
"Your funds arrived and were distributed to Betty," Jack said. "She's a much-relieved woman, and she thanks you."
"My pleasure. It's a wonderful boat, but then I already knew that because it's my second one. You should come visit when I'm in England, Jack. You'd like it." "You're in London?"
"No, on the south coast, near Beaulieu and the Solent."
"Pretty country." They were hailed from ashore, and Harry Kaufelt and his partner, Moe, came aboard. Jack listened intently while Stone related the events at Fort Jefferson.
"You didn't mention that," Jack said.
"I didn't want you to be concerned."
"The Coast Guard were ready for the return of the shooter," Harry said, "but the boat never showed up."
"They probably went somewhere up the Keys," Jack said. "There's 150 miles of shoreline up there to hide them."
"Exactly right," Harry said. "If we had a better description of the boat, we might have a better chance of finding it. The three outboards are the only distinguishing feature we have, and there are lots of those on the water."
"Don't forget the damaged radome," Dino said. "I put a bullet in that."
Harry got on his phone and issued instructions to spread the word to electronics dealers in the Keys. He hung up.
"How much longer are you staying?" he asked Stone.
"Anxious to get rid of us, Harry?" Stone asked.
"Not in the least. I just want to know how much longer I need to worry about you."
"I expect we'll wing our way north the day after tomorrow," Stone replied. "Miss Harmon has some business to conduct tomorrow afternoon, then we'll be free to go. And don't worry, I've arranged security at the Casa Marina for her meeting."
"Is this the thing with the driverless car?"
"That's right.
We were warned that one would be in the neighborhood and not to arrest the driver, since there won't be one."
"That's good advice," Stone said. The cops left, and Jack Spotswood finished his drink and left, too. When they got home, Anna had left a big pot of beef stew on the stove, so they didn't have to make dinner. The board of directors of the Steel Group stood at the front of the Casa Marina Hotel and waited for something to happen. Men in suits with bulges under their jackets stood quietly by, also waiting for something terrible to happen. "All right, gentlemen," Meg said, taking out her iPhone. "We've just finished a good dinner, and now we need our car." She opened an app and tapped a few keys. From around a corner, a bright red car with no driver in sight appeared, turned into the hotel's block, then stopped and flawlessly backed into a parallel parking spot. Two more cars, green and yellow, followed, then the three vehicles drove up to the front door of the hotel, stopped, and all their doors opened.
"'Miss Harmon,' a voice said from inside the lead vehicle, "'your cars are here for your party.'
The board members got into the vehicles, and Stone rode in the lead car with Meg, who sat in what would ordinarily be the driver's seat.
"'Where to, Miss Harmon?' the car asked. "'Key West International Airport,' she said. "'The departure set down.'
"'Yes, ma'am,' the car said. And the little caravan set off, negotiating turns, stopping at stop signs and traffic signals, avoiding careless tourists crossing the road in front of them, and giving bicycles and scooters a wide berth. At the airport, the cars pulled up to where departing passengers would be set down.
"'You are at your destination,' the car said. "'Would you like me to call someone to help with your luggage?'
"'No, thank you,' Meg replied. "'We've decided not to leave, but to go back to the Casa Marina instead.
"'Would you like a sightseeing tour on your way?'
"'Why not?' she replied. The cars set off again, while the car radio broadcast a continuous guided tour of the town, giving the riders a history, pointing out landmarks, and making a few jokes. Presently they were driven back to the hotel, where the passengers got out and the cars drove away. Meg got a big round of applause from the board.
"'That's very impressive, Meg,' Arthur Steele said for the group. "'Do the vehicles always operate so flawlessly?'
"'They certainly do,' Meg said. "'We're now ready to proceed from beta testing,' to fleet trials for the Department of Transportation and the State of California. We've also assigned vehicles to about 24 officials for their daily commutes and normal uses.
A smart move, Arthur said.
Well, Meg replied, it will be much better than waiting for them to read the written reports from their testing staff. There's nothing like a hands-off experience to sell a new idea. That got a big laugh from the board, and everybody went inside for a cocktail party, joining selected investors of both the Steel Group and Harmony Software.
"'That was spectacular,' Stone said to Meg as they followed the group.
"'It kind of was, wasn't it?' Meg replied with a big smile.
"'Tell me,' Stone said. What would have happened if one or more of the cars was involved in an accident?
First of all, no accident would have occurred that could be blamed on the cars, only other driver-operated vehicles. And our cars are very good at anticipating errors by drivers of other cars. But if an accident had somehow happened, the cars would have collaborated with each other on an assessment of the injuries and damage, taking only a few seconds. Then the police and ambulances, if necessary, would have been automatically notified. By the time they arrived, the cars would have printed out a completed standard form accident report for the police and the insurance company, and the passengers would have been on their way again in record time.
"'You've thought of everything, haven't you?'
"'We better have,' Meg replied.
13. The following morning, Stone called Joan and let her know they were returning to New York a little early.
"'Everything all right?' she asked.
"'Yes.'
"'Do you want Fred to meet you?'
"'Good idea.' I'll be bringing a guest, and we'd be crowded in Dino's car.
I'll let Helene know, too. Dining in tonight?
I expect so. Just the two of us in my study.
You should know that when you arrive, you'll find an unexpected guest waiting for you.
Who's that?
You'll see,
Joan replied, then hung up.
Stone wondered if that person could be of the female persuasion. He would not be comfortable with such a presence on this occasion. He nearly called Joan back and told her to clear the decks, but decided instead to rely on her discretion.
They arrived at the Key West airport and left the car in the lot for George to pick up, then walked out to the airplane. Stone unlocked the baggage compartments and began loading luggage.
"You didn't tell me you had your own airplane," Meg said. "I was expecting an airliner."
"What's money for?" Stone asked.
"I don't see any pilots."
"There's just one, and you're looking at him."
She appeared a little uncomfortable.
"Are you concerned about my piloting skills?" Stone asked her.
"Not at all, except maybe when I'm aboard that," she said, pointing at the Citation.
"If you're uncomfortable, I'll be happy to put you on an airline, but it will be close to bedtime before you arrive, since you'd probably have to make a couple of stops to change airplanes."
Viv stepped in. "Meg, we've flown with Stone many times, and believe me, you will be in good hands. You and I can talk on the way about your security arrangements in New York."
Reluctantly, Meg climbed aboard the airplane and took a seat with Viv in the passenger compartment, while Stone conducted a pre-flight inspection. Dino took the co-pilot's seat. He didn't fly himself, but he liked to complain about Stone's flying. They were first in line for takeoff, and a minute later they were climbing in a northerly direction before joining Stone's filed flight plan. Within half an hour, they were at flight level 400, or 40,000 feet. Stone adjusted the heating for comfort and let the autopilot do the rest, then turned on some classical music in the hope of soothing Meg. The air was smooth up high, and there wasn't a cloud in sight.
"A good day to have Meg as a passenger," Dino said, looking around. "God help us if she sees a thunderstorm or we fly through a cloud."
"You think I should have warned her that I would be flying? It never crossed my mind."
"I think that if you had, she'd be aboard an airliner now."
Stone opened the New York Times.
"You're in charge," he said to Dino. "Let me know if anything awful happens."
They had a strong tailwind and flew at around 500 knots over the ground for most of the trip. As they flew the arrival procedure for Teterboro, they descended through some clouds until they were at 3,000 feet. Shortly, they picked up the instrument landing system for runway 6, and Stone put down the crossword puzzle. Cars were not normally allowed on the ramp at Jet Aviation, but Dino's was, and Fred had managed to follow his car through the gates and out to the airplane. Dino went back and helped the women down the stairs, while linemen took their luggage to the appropriate vehicles. Shortly they were on their way into the city, well ahead of rush-hour traffic, Dino and Viv in his car, and Stone and Meg in the rear seat of the Bentley.
"You're very quiet," Stone said.
"I'm still calming down," she replied. "I mean, I relaxed a lot when we were high up, but when we began to come down and flew through those clouds, I got nervous again."
"Clouds are just collections of water vapor. Do you get nervous during airline flights?"
"No, not anymore."
"I hope you'll get used to flying with me. Did you ever consider a corporate aircraft?"
"I didn't really fly all that much on business for a long time, so it seemed unnecessary."
"You should think about it now. I'm sure the board would approve the expenditure, since all of them fly corporate."
"Do you fly yourself going overseas?"
"Yes. I have a house in England and one in Paris. I fly up to Newfoundland, refuel, then go non-stop from there. Coming back against the wind, I stop in Iceland or the Azores as well to refuel."
"You make it sound like a very ordinary way to travel," she said.
"It is, for me. I don't enjoy the airport experience, and as you saw, we managed to avoid all that."
"It's certainly a convenient way to travel, and I will be crossing the country a lot."
"If you want to look into it, I can find a consultant to help you find an aircraft that meets your needs."
I'll think about it.
They arrived at Stone's house and left Fred to deal with the luggage, then went to Stone's office. Bob, his Labrador retriever, ran to him with tail wagging, and to Stone's surprise, a nearly identical lab followed him, wagging all over. "Who's this?" he asked Joan after he had introduced Meg.
"That's your surprise visitor," she said. "Her name is Sugar, and she belongs to a lady across the street. We met when walking them, and she asked me to keep Sugar for a couple of days while she was away. Bob is agreeable to the arrangement, as you can see."
"I hope we're not going to have a lot of lab puppies running around here any time soon," Stone said.
"I don't suppose you've noticed, but Bob has been deprived of that function, and so, I'm told, has Sugar."
Stone took Meg up in the elevator and into the master suite, where her clothes had been unpacked and put into the second dressing room. Meg inspected the premises.
"I like the way you live," she said.
"Thank you. So do I."
"And now that I'm on the ground safely, I feel better about your flying arrangements. I don't think I'll have a problem with it next time."
"I'm glad of that. I'd rather fly with you than without you."
Gino and Veronica Bellini got through baggage and customs and found a driver waiting for them. Once in the car, Gino said,
"I'm going to buy a fucking airplane."
"That's fine by me," Veronica said, "as long as you're not flying it. I mean, when you had the little airplane, I kind of enjoyed flying with you, but anything bigger, I'd like a pro, no, two pros, up front."
"I'll start looking into it tomorrow," he said.
"How much does that sort of airplane cost?"
"New, somewhere between $5 and $50 million, depending on your tastes."
"That's quite a price range."
"I expect we could get something suitable for $10 or $15 million.
"Why don't we wait until you screw a lot more money out of Meg Harmon?" Veronica said.
"There won't be long to wait," Gino replied.
14. They dined before a cheerful fire in Stone's study. Bob and Sugar slept by the hearth, curled up together.
"I like your house," Meg said. "How old is it?"
70 years or so. I inherited it from my great-aunt, my grandmother's sister. I did most of the restoration work myself, just about everything that didn't require a license, like plumbing and electrics.
"How could you afford to live here on a police detective's salary?"
"I couldn't," Stone replied. "I was up to my ears in debt when an old friend from law school invited me to join his firm. I had never gotten a law license, so I took a cram course and passed the bar. He had it in mind that I specialize in handling the cases the firm didn't want to be seen handling. In short, the personal, often messy side of clients' lives. My experience as a cop helped."
"That doesn't sound as though it could make you rich enough to live like this."
"Oh, I did better and better as time passed, and my clients got better, too. Then I married the widow of an actor. You remember Vance Calder?"
"Who doesn't?"
"Arrington and I had had a relationship for a while when she met Vance, and they were soon married. He had become extremely wealthy during his long career. Arrington didn't know it, but she was pregnant when they married. Our son, Peter, who took my name after Vance's death, is a film director in Los Angeles, and his partner is Dino's son, Ben."
"So you married a rich widow?"
"I did, and I helped her become richer before she was murdered by an ex-lover."
"And you inherited everything?"
"Oh, no, only about a third. The bulk of it went into a trust for Peter, which I manage. He's old enough now to take charge of it himself, but he's asked me to continue in that role."
So, like me, you became suddenly rich?
Not quite. I was doing very well in my practice, and I was made a partner in Goodman and Weld. While she was alive, we lived mostly on my income, while continuing to build her fortune. I preferred it that way.
But you experienced the shock of suddenly being able to have anything you want, just as I did.
Not exactly. That took a while to dawn on me. That's when I started buying houses. My great weakness, as you have come to know.
I could use some advice on how to conduct myself, Meg said.
Stone took a sip of his wine. Go shopping, he said.
I have already done so, she replied, laughing.
Not just clothes and jewelry. Art, if you like it. The airplane we talked about, a place in New York, and maybe a vacation house somewhere you love. The aircraft can take you there.
Just keep remembering you earned it, and you deserve it.
That's more than I could say for myself.
That's good advice. I didn't ask you about your family.
Ah, they're an interesting story. My parents grew up together in a town in western Massachusetts called Great Barrington. They were, I think, third cousins, and their fathers were both in the textile business, woolens, mainly. When it became obvious that the young people were attracted to each other, their parents deeply disapproved.
Why? Genetics?
No, politics. My father, and to a lesser extent my mother, held leftist views. My father was for a while a card-carrying communist. He had no interest in his family's wealth or their business. I think he felt guilty that he had had such a privileged upbringing. He was at Yale when he discovered a love for woodworking, and he wanted to make that his trade. His father, of course, wanted him in the business, but he disdained that. After a couple of years at Yale, which he had spent seeing my mother as much as possible, she was at Mount Holyoke, they eloped. He dropped out of college, and they moved to New York to live a bohemian existence. My mother was a talented painter. Both their parents disowned them, my father for being a communist, my mother for marrying my father.
And your father became a woodworker?
Not at first. That required space for a shop and a lot of expensive tools. He began by going door to door in Greenwich Village with his toolbox, offering to do odd jobs. Gradually, he got small commissions, a bookcase, a dining table. My mother's paintings were selling, and together they saved enough to make a down payment on a house with room for a shop in the cellar. After a few years, he had earned an excellent reputation as a designer and craftsman. In fact, he made just about every wooden thing in this house. I helped him when I was a teenager, and I learned the skills from him that helped me renovate this house. They're both gone now.
What a lovely story.
What about your family?
My father was an aeronautical engineer, and after Stanford he was hired by Douglas Aircraft and made a career there. He was on the design team for many of their models. My mother taught high school in Santa Monica, and they lived near her work and his. I was born late in their marriage. Quite a surprise, I think. We were solidly middle class. I didn't have to work my way through college. I had a golden California girlhood, spent a lot of time at the beach, with boys who were clearly not going to amount to anything, although a few of them did. One made a fortune building surfboards. I was interested in engineering, but more interested in electronics. I followed my father to Stanford, where I studied computer science instead of airplanes. I worked at Apple for a while. Then, when they showed too little interest in what I wanted to do, I started consulting, wrote a couple of pieces of successful commercial software, which made me some cash, founded Harmony, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Fred cleared their dishes, and Stone poured them both a cognac.
Then he leaned back in his chair and regarded her. "Why do I get the feeling that I haven't heard the whole story about you and Gino Bellini?"
"Well," she said, "I guess that's because I haven't told you the whole story."
"If I'm going to stop him from ruining your business and killing you, I think I should know everything."